Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
Today, Donald Trump was in a place that he will be spending lots of time this year, and that is, of course, a courthouse. This one was for closing arguments in the New York civil trial against the Trump Organization for Fraud. The ex-president was there attempting to derail the final day with a statement to the press when he got there and a statement to the press when he left, and in between, a five-minute courtroom rant in his defense, a rant that ended with the judge telling Trump's lawyers, quote, control your client. Trump's antics are getting most of the headlines. But to my mind, the real headline of today happened before anyone arrived at the courthouse.
Mary, we are just days away from the caucus, and the former president is a world away from Iowa here in lower Manhattan. But in many ways, this was a campaign stop for Trump. He used it as a political move to rally his base, even as he faces real legal consequences for his business here in New York. Here at the courthouse in New York, security is a little tighter today following a bomb threat made this morning at the judge's home.
That's right. A bomb threat to Judge Arthur Engoron's home. His actual real home, because it's not hard to find people's addresses in the 21st century, a threat that delayed the trial this morning because they had to do sweeps and add extra layers of security because someone had called a bomb threat into the judge's home. We don't know all the particulars of that. We don't know who did it. But it appears to be the latest example of mob-style intimidation by pro-Trump MAGA loyalists that has become disturbingly common. Just a part of day-to-day life in the Trump era. Oh, bomb threat. Oh, yeah, got to delay a little bit. I mean, remember, when this trial began last fall, Judge Engoron had to slap a gag order on Trump after the former president baselessly smeared a court officer on social media, saying she was a political operative, including a photo of her in the Post. And she and the judge were subsequently flooded with threats, and not just threats, anti-Semitic slurs and harassing voicemail. She reportedly got 30 threatening calls a day on her cell phone, her personal cell phone, 50 a day on email and social media. The FBI and Homeland Security got involved. The court officer, again, this is an anonymous staffer at the court, basically, right? Now needs extra security. So on top of that, you now have a bomb threat at, again, the home of the judge. These happen in life sometimes, and we sort of say it and move past it. But I want you to just take a second of, like, what your day would have been like today if it started with a bomb threat at your home, okay? And everything I just said is one Trump trial. One. It follows a pattern of dangerous and potentially violent intimidation of people who have attempted to hold Donald Trump to account under the rule of law. There were the death threats made last month against the Colorado Supreme Court justices who ruled Trump ineligible for the ballot under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment for having supported the Capitol insurrection. A week later, the Secretary of State for Maine, who determined, like the Colorado court, that Trump is similarly ineligible for the ballot, was a victim of a hoax emergency call that a man had broken into her home, sending the police there, something called swatting, right? With the idea of getting a SWAT team to show up at a person's home. Then on Christmas Day, Jack Smith, the Department of Justice special counsel, was targeted with one of those fake calls. Someone called 911 claiming he had shot his wife. Just last weekend, Tanya Chutkan, the federal judge who was overseeing Trump's criminal trial for election interference, when police responded to a false report of a shooting at her house. She was home at the time. To be clear, that was not even the first time Judge Chutkan was threatened over her work on this trial.
A Texas woman was arrested and charged with threatening a federal judge who was overseeing Donald Trump's election case in Washington, D.C. Authorities had already increased security around U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan after the former president demanded her recusal last week. Prosecutors say the 43-year-old defendant left a threatening voicemail message for Chutkan saying, quote, if Trump doesn't get elected in 2024, we are coming to kill you.
That was from this past August. Now, keep in mind, we just began this week with Trump's lawyer in federal court making the argument that he could send SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival and face zero sanctions or accountability or legal consequences so long as he held on to 34 loyal votes in the Senate. Now, that is the most extreme version of Trump's openly fascistic vision of politics and power. But what I want to stress to you tonight, on a day that began with a bomb threat at the home of a judge overseeing a trial, is the banal daily version of those politics is here already. It's not a hypothetical. That version is people that cross Donald Trump in pursuit of holding him accountable to the law face constant threats of violence and intimidation and harassment and sometimes actual violence. Most obvious example being, of course, January 6th, when he told people to march to the Capitol, and he said it will be wild. And after they had ransacked the Capitol and he watched them do it, he went after his vice president, Mike Pence, who was in a secure location with the Secret Service, painting a target on the man's back, putting Pence in genuine physical peril with rioters erecting a gallows with a noose. Trump's celebration of violent threats against his perceived antagonist goes back years.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise.
And when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice.
I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. Like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
People hear this message loud and clear, no matter how much he tries to cover it in the cadence of comedy. People like, for instance, real people like Cesar Sayoc. Remember that name? The devoted MAGA fan who went to lots of Trump rallies in the lead up to the 2018 midterms. You may know him better as the MAGA bomber who, on the eve of those midterms, made a list of people he saw as enemies of Donald Trump and mailed them pipe bombs. People like Joe Biden and George Soros and Barack Obama. And then there was the attack on Nancy Pelosi's elderly husband, Paul, who on the eve of the next midterms in 2022 was nearly killed in his home with a hammer by a man who had fallen down a right-wing rabbit hole on the internet. Paul Pelosi had his skull fractured. And what did Trump do? What does he still do today? He jokes about that attack. Continuously, it's part of his routine. Sending the message to everyone who listens to him that it was funny and it was good that the man nearly killed Paul Pelosi with a hammer in his home. That is a funny thing. And he's out there doing it right now, just the other day. After the immunity argument where his lawyers argued he could order the assassination of political rivals, Trump comes outside to threaten violence. He said there will be, quote, bedlam in the country if he doesn't get immunity from prosecution for his crimes. It's the same thing he did when he told his supporters before January 6th, be there, we'll be wild. Then he told them Mike Pence didn't have the guts to do what needed to be done. Like, we all understand what's happening here, right? All of us? You think it's a coincidence that this week, after he said there would be bedlam, there was a bomb threat directed at the judge in his New York trial? I don't know. Maybe. But I do know that when you look at the worst case, most intolerable incursion of essentially fascistic violence by the MAGA faction, combined with Trump's legal arguments in court, you have to consider that we are already living with a version of it in America today, every day.
Well, howdy there, Internet people. It's Bo again. So today we are going to talk about Trump and SEAL Team 6. And we're going to follow that to its ultimate conclusion. I was a little bit out of the loop when it came to news yesterday because I was dealing with the whole, tornado thing. But when I got back and started reading up, I found out that the president's legal team was in court arguing that he could order SEAL Team 6 to eliminate his political rivals, and he would only face criminal liability for that if the House and the Senate impeached and convicted him. If they didn't do that, well, he can't even be charged for that. You know, when he started claiming presidential immunity, I knew that these scenarios, the hypotheticals that were going to get posed, I knew his legal team was going to have to answer yes to some pretty wild scenarios, because to create a precedent where presidential immunity covers the conduct that is being discussed in his charges, it has to just be all-encompassing. I didn't expect it to go this far. But let's just follow it through. So we have a new president. His name is President Smith. President Smith gets made fun of on Twitter by somebody. So he orders SEAL Team 6 to remove them from circulation permanently, because they're a political rival of his. Now, the House and the Senate have to impeach and convict. Otherwise, President Smith walks. What do you think those conversations in the House and the Senate are going to be like? Do you really want to become the political rival of President Smith? Because all he has to do is have you removed permanently, have you planted. The former president of the United States, somebody who is seeking that office again, the legal team argued in court that he should be allowed to be a dictator. There's no other way to read that. Because nobody can oppose him politically. If they do, well, SEAL Team 6 is going to go take him out. And he can't be held responsible, can't be held accountable for that, unless he's impeached and convicted. But the second they start that process, well, they're his political rivals, right? So what would he do? There are a whole lot of people who still do not want to accept that Trump isn't a normal Republican. There are a lot of people in the Democratic Party or to the left who don't really want to accept exactly how bad he is for this country. His team argued in court that without being impeached and convicted, he could eliminate political rivals using the military within the United States. That's what his team argued. And if you follow that chain of events, anybody who wanted to impeach or convict becomes a political rival. They might suffer the same fate. If you still support this man, you really need to, reevaluate everything in your life and really pay attention to what he is arguing, what he is wanting the courts to give him the power to do. Anyway, it's just a thought. Y'all have a good day.
Trump just stochastically threatened mass political violence and terrorism again while trying to get out of a trial in which he is charged with orchestrating mass political violence and terrorism. And his attorney told the three-judge appeals panel, in essence, that Trump also had the right to order the assassination of a domestic political rival, and as long as he was not impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate, he could not be prosecuted for doing so. I will go out of chronological order about this because, sorry, he's still doing it, and he's still not being treated the way we would treat any other terrorist who threatens violence, or as he calls it, bedlam. Bedlam if the case against him is not dropped. It's a terrorist threat. But listen carefully at the end for a reporter who actually sort of called him out on it.
Very mind-boggling if you happen to be Joe Biden. And I think they feel this is the way they're going to try and win. And that's not the way it goes. It'll be bedlam in the country.
You just used the word bedlam. Will you tell your supporters now, no matter what, no violence?
So, no, huh? DC reporter, you have unsuspected depth. Even the most both-sidesist of publications, Axios, heard the terrorism in there and described that as Trump's violence warning. Warning being legally correct, but not exactly conveying the fact that if that was a warning, it was like the standard mob warning. Or a warning from Vladimir Putin about making sure you pay somebody else to wash your upper floor windows. Axios did describe the bedlam and the assassination interludes as, quote, two stunning moments. As to the assassination of domestic rivals, his attorney John Sauer told the three-judge appeals panel that, yeah, Trump could be prosecuted for killing a guy if he was impeached and removed from office. And that's bad. Well, no, that's good, because all three judges, including the one appointed by the first President Bush, were a little skeptical about that. So that's good. No, that's bad, because this presidential immunity fiction is not about winning or losing. It's about stalling. And this alone, this has managed to stall it for a couple of more weeks. And that's bad. No, that's good, because only the Bush judge seemed to bite at an idea that the appeals court should send the argument back to a lower court to determine which, if any, of the Jack Smith charges against Trump might be subject to this presidential immunity jazz. And the other two judges seemed even more skeptical of this than they were about Trump can order SEAL Team 6 to kill President Biden. And that's good. No, that's bad. Because the idea of any appeals court sending any part of this case or any other case against Trump back down to a lower court would waste even more time on Trump's behalf. And presumably somebody at the Republican Supreme Religious Court heard this and said, send it back to the lower court. Genius. Why? That's a Perry Mason moment. Thank you, Nancy Faust. Back to the District of Columbia Appeals Court and the attorney John Sauer. And there's a fun fact about him in a moment. And Judge Florence Pan and whatever it is that made this Sauer guy, and that's an apt description of him too, believe that there is a presidential right to assassinate and get away with it. And also, by the way, another right to sell pardons or sell military secrets. And also that president's lawyer's right to filibuster the court.
Order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival. Order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival. That's an official act in order to SEAL Team 6.
He would have to be and would speedily be, you know, impeached and convicted before the criminal prosecution.
But if you weren't, there would be no criminal prosecution, no criminal liability for that.
Chief Justice's opinion in Marbury against Madison and our constitutional tradition and the plain language of the impeachment judgment clause all clearly presuppose that what the founders were concerned about was not.
I asked you a yes or no question. Could a president who ordered SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival who was not impeached, would he be subject to criminal prosecution?
If he were impeached and convicted first.
So your answer is?
My answer is qualified. Yes, there is a political process that would have to occur under the structure of our Constitution.
The extra fact, if you want to laugh, that Trump attorney there, Sauer, started as the law clerk to a conservative judge named Michael Luttig. Michael 14th Amendment Luttig. See, he didn't learn anything from you, Judge. Judge Pan and Judge Michelle Childs did not bring up several fundamental hypocrisies within Trump's positions in this trial. He is claiming his actions to overturn the 2020 election were just a president doing his job, ferreting out election corruption. But the damnedest thing is, he only looked for that corruption in the states he lost. Also, he is claiming you cannot prosecute an ex-president while promising he will prosecute an ex-president. But Judge Childs did note that if ex-presidents are immune, why in the hell did Nixon ask Ford for a pardon? And the Bush appointee, Judge Karen Henderson, noted, quoting, "I think it's paradoxical to say that his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed allows him to violate criminal law." Good point. Trump attended the hearing because lying to his cult that he was forced to go to court and then standing in a nice, warm, indoor space in front of TV cameras, threatening America with bedlam, rather than going outside and campaigning in Des Moines, Iowa, where the real feel yesterday was 16, that's so much easier, and it's beginning to be so obvious that he is so tired. Back to the main point of this. Besides the background drumbeat of domestic political violence and murder and bedlam, the team at justsecurity.org game planned where the presidential immunity delay would put the timeline for the Jack Smith subversion trial of loser J. Trump. They've got three scenarios. I'll skip the legal reasons for the differences, but in the quickest of them, it has the Supreme Court only being able to delay the start of his trial until about May 19th, which means it would wrap up by about July 7th. A second scenario would see the trial finish by July 17th. But a third one has the trial not even starting until early June and not completing until mid-August. And then you know what happens? Our old friend, the DOJ 60-day unwritten rule, stumbles drunkenly back into town. He has not really made a fool out of us since 2016, when James Comey managed to mishandle Hillary's emails both ways, by first staying quiet when it was still early enough to say something, and then by not staying quiet when it was too late to say anything. The DOJ will not take any steps that might impact an upcoming election within the 60-day span before that election, and that's September 5th of this year, or as Trump would call it, Christmas. We don't know, particularly after the Comey fiasco, what the DOJ would now do about the prosecution of an ex-president for trying to stop the peaceful transfer of power and to defraud every voter in the country if the trial was still in progress as the date of the election he is running in arrives in this rule that is not a law, but they do it anyway just cause.
From the White House in the office of the President of the United States, we present an address by Dwight D. Eisenhower. This is the farewell address for President Eisenhower, whose 8 years as chief executive come to an end at noon Friday. Mr. Eisenhower has chosen this time for his final speech. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. First, I should like to express my gratitude to the radio and television networks for the opportunities they have given me over the years to bring reports and messages to our nation. My special thanks go to them for the opportunity of addressing you this evening. 3 days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen. Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all. Our people expect their president and the Congress to find essential agreement on issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation. My own relations with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when, long ago, a member of the Senate appointed me to West Point, have since ranged to the intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually interdependent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well. To serve the nation good rather than mere partisanship, and so have assured that the business of the nation should go forward. So my official relationship with the Congress ends in a feeling, on my part, of gratitude that we have been able to do so much together. We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed 4 major wars among great nations. 3 of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interests of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's adventure in free government, our basic purposes have been to keep the peace, to foster progress in human achievement, and to enhance liberty, dignity, and integrity among peoples and among nations. To strive for less would be unworthy of a free and religious people. Any failure traceable to arrogance or our lack of comprehension or readiness to sacrifice would inflict upon us grievous hurt, both at home and abroad. Progress toward these noble goals is persistently threatened by the conflict now engulfing the world. It commands our whole attention, absorbs our very beings. We face a hostile ideology, global in scope, atheistic in character, ruthless in purpose, and insidious in method. Unhappily, the danger it poses promises to be of indefinite duration. To meet it successfully, there is call for not so much the emotional and transitory sacrifices of crisis, but rather those which enable us to carry forward steadily, surely, and without complaint, the burdens of a prolonged and complex struggle with liberty the stake. Only thus shall we remain, despite every provocation, on our charted course toward permanent peace and human betterment. Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses, development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture, a dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel. But each proposal must be weighed in the light of a broader consideration, the need to maintain balance in and among national programs. Balance between the private and the public economy. Balance between the cost and hoped-for advantages. Balance between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable. Balance between our essential requirements as a nation and the duties imposed by the nation upon the individual. Balance between actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. Good judgment seeks balance and progress. Lack of it eventually finds imbalance and frustration. The record of many decades stands as proof that our people and their government have, in the main, understood these truths and have responded to them well in the face of threat and stress. But threats, new in kind or degree, constantly arise. Of these, I mention 2 only. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, so that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. It is the task of statesmanship to mold, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society. Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Such a confederation must be one of equals. The weakest must come to the conference table with the same competence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. That table, though scarred by many past frustrations, cannot be abandoned for the certainty agony of disarmament of the battlefield. Disarmament with mutual honor and confidence is a continuing imperative. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. Because this need is so sharp and apparent, I confess that I lay down my official responsibilities in this field with a definite sense of disappointment. As one who has witnessed the horror and the lingering sadness of war, as one who knows that another war could utterly destroy this civilization, which has been so slowly and painfully built over thousands of years, I wish I could say tonight that a lasting peace is in sight. Happily, I can say that war has been avoided. Steady progress toward our ultimate goal has been made, but so much remains to be done. As a private citizen, I shall never cease to do what little I can to help the world advance along that road. So in this, my last good night to you as your president, I thank you for the many opportunities you have given me for public service in war and in peace. I trust in that service, you find some things worthy. As for the rest of it, I know you will find ways to improve performance in the future. You and I, my fellow citizens, need to be strong in our faith that all nations under God will reach the goal of peace with justice. May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the sources, scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. Now, on Friday noon, I am to become a private citizen. I am proud to do so. I look forward to it. Thank you, and good night.
The very precision of drone strikes and the necessary secrecy often involved in such actions can end up shielding our government from the public scrutiny that a troop deployment invites. It could also lead a president and his team to view drone strikes as a cure-all for terrorism. And for this reason, I've insisted on strong oversight of all lethal action. After I took office, my administration began briefing all strikes outside of Iraq and Afghanistan to the appropriate committees of Congress. Let me repeat that. Not only did Congress authorize the use of force, it is briefed on every strike that America takes. Every strike. That includes the one instance where we targeted an American citizen, Anwar al-Awlaki, the chief of external operations for AQAP. Now, this week, I authorized the declassification of this action and the deaths of three other Americans in drone strikes to facilitate transparency and debate on this issue and to dismiss some of the more outlandish claims that have been made. For the record, I do not believe it would be constitutional for the government to target and kill any U.S. citizen with a drone or with a shotgun without due process. Nor should any president deploy armed drones over U.S. soil. But when a U.S. citizen goes abroad to wage war against America and is actively plotting to kill U.S. citizens, and when neither the United States nor our partners are in a position to capture him before he carries out a plot, his citizenship should no more serve as a shield than a sniper shooting down on an innocent crowd should be protected from a SWAT team. That's who Anwar al-Awlaki was. He was continuously trying to kill people. He helped oversee the 2010 plot to detonate explosive devices on two U.S.-bound cargo planes. He was involved in planning to blow up an airliner in 2009. When Farouk Abdulmutallab, the Christmas Day bomber, went to Yemen in 2009, al-Awlaki hosted him, approved his suicide operation, helped him tape a martyrdom video to be shown after the attack, and his last instructions were to blow up the airplane when it was over American soil. I would have detained and prosecuted al-Awlaki if we captured him before he carried out a plot, but we couldn't. And as president, I would have been derelict in my duty had I not authorized the strike that took him out. Of course, the targeting of any American raises constitutional issues that are not present in other strikes, which is why my administration submitted information about al-Awlaki to the Department of Justice months before al-Awlaki was killed and briefed the Congress before this strike as well. But the high threshold that we've set for taking lethal action applies to all potential terrorist targets, regardless of whether or not they are American citizens. This threshold respects the inherent dignity of every human life, alongside the decision to put our men and women in uniform in harm's way. The decision to use force against individuals or groups, even against a sworn enemy of the United States, is the hardest thing I do as president. But these decisions must be made, given my responsibility to protect the American people. Now, going forward, I've asked my administration to review proposals to extend oversight of lethal actions outside of war zones that go beyond our reporting to Congress. Each option has virtues in theory, but poses difficulties in practice. For example, the establishment of a special court to evaluate and authorize lethal action has the benefit of bringing a third branch of government into the process, but raises serious constitutional issues about presidential and judicial authority. Another idea that's been suggested, the establishment of an independent oversight board in the executive branch, avoids those problems but may introduce a layer of bureaucracy into national security decision-making without inspiring additional public confidence in the process. But despite these challenges, I look forward to actively engaging Congress to explore these and other options for increased oversight. I believe, however, that the use of force must be seen as part of a larger discussion we need to have about a comprehensive counterterrorism strategy, because for all the focus on the use of force, force alone cannot make us safe. We cannot use force everywhere that a radical ideology takes root. And in the absence of a strategy that reduces the wellspring of extremism, a perpetual war through drones or special forces or troop deployments will prove self-defeating and alter our country in troubling ways. So the next element of our strategy involves addressing the underlying grievances and conflicts that feed extremism.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim,
Show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, I'm your brother, my man, D-Soka, yeah. And welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast, emergency episode. I'm technically not following my own rules with releasing this emergency episode. The rules, arbitrary as they may be, that I set for myself was that if I called it an emergency episode, it would have to be released within 3 to 4 days of my recording it. This one, I wanted to take some time to find some appropriate content to actually include with it. I wanted to make sure that all of the clips, the audio clips that you hear, needed to be there. This episode is about SEAL Team 6, Trump's trump card over democracy. I feared this day would come. I feared this day would come. It was either 2010 or 2011 or 2012, I don't remember the year now, when some Republican started talking about Second Amendment solutions. Second Amendment solutions. It was laughable. But yet, serious, everybody knew what Second Amendment solutions were. One political group picking up guns and using them against another political group. Eliminating political rivals, if you might want to say that. Possibly even shooting at them. Only if to scare them away from doing the work that they were doing. In the black community, there is this unspoken reality that has confused many of us for years. Anytime And this is less so over the last 5 or 6 years. But this was a constant in the 80s, in the 90s, in the early 2000s. Anytime somebody with significant street cred begin to build influence within the black community, begin to build a rapport, especially with the wayward men and women within gang fealties. Anytime an individual would start to do that and start trying to change the lives of those men and women, changing their minds from gang fealty to political fealty to community fealty to a higher cultural fealty than living gang life, suddenly that person would end up shot, injured significantly, so that they could no longer do that work, or in prison for some charge which took them away from that work for a decade or more, where then upon being released, and sometimes it was 4 or 5 years, but upon being released, they would have to serve parole for 20 years, making it absolutely impossible due to the restrictions of parole for them to do the work that they had been doing. By that I mean, a lot of states, when it comes to parole, they would say, well, you can't be around known felons, you can't be around known gang members, you can't be around possible illicit substances, you can't be around a lot of the things that a person trying to save and change lives of gang members would likely have to be around in order to change those lives and save those lives. Or, and this happened a lot, they would be killed. I remember when I was a younger man, one pastor in grief, in audible grief, upon arriving at a scene to discover that one of his most promising young parishioners had been murdered, said, people keep saying it's senseless, but it's not senseless. Every time we get a young man or woman like this, they seem to get murdered. That's not senseless. There's somebody doing this to make sure that we do not grow a generation that repeats the 60s. Who knows if it was true or not? I think about that. I think about it because I know people, white people, who believe wholeheartedly that at some very near date, they are going to have to pick up their guns and act as all true great patriots act, with bloodlust and determination to murder those who they see as eroding the United States from the inside out. Specifically, its institutions, cultural, governmental, and social. Now, while they are adamant that they would be discriminating, that there would be a process to figuring out who was the enemy and who was not, they are equally as adamant that death would be rained down upon those who do not share their way of thinking, their way of knowing, their way of existing. And it is their duty to do it. I know white people who believe that. Many of them, former military. Some of them, former law enforcement. But most of them, neither. They're just ordinary citizens who believe that if you are an American citizen, you must be conservative. Not only just conservative, you must be rabidly jingoistic, rabidly nationalistic, and rabidly bloodthirsty for the internal spillings of those who are not like you. The American citizen, one of my friends once told me, has an obligation, a duty, to protect the country by all means necessary. I laughed a little when he said it, because, you know, figured he was going to do the Malcolm X thing. By any means necessary. But no, by all means necessary. And I asked him, you mean murder? And he said, the revolution involved killing people. Why not? Okay. He goes, I know it's hard to believe, but, you know, people say that the tree of liberty must be refreshed periodically with the blood of tyrants. He goes, the same thing is true with traitors. There's a lot of people masquerading as citizens who are actual traitors to this country. They were born here, they were raised here, and they still don't see it as they should. It's a grotesque view, y'all. That's my statement to that. But how should we really view such a statement? Should we view it as grotesque? My reaction is yes. But the history of the United States says no. We shouldn't view it as grotesque. We should view it as the truth manifest in words. Or even the truth manifest through words. We talk about the dispossession, the genociding of Native Indigenous people. But come on. A lot of that was bloodthirst motivated. Because the Native Indigenous people did not believe what the white people wanted them to believe, which was that white people were superior and that they should control the land and that God had given them this land. Boy, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound like something that's happening in the Middle East right now? Anyway, because Native Indigenous people didn't believe that the arm of the divine had given this land over to the Europeans, they had to be dispossessed. They had to be murdered. But not only did they have to be murdered, they had to be disrespected in being murdered. It was applauded, their deaths. It was seen as the job of the cavalries and the military of this country to murder Native Indigenous people. We talk a good game about what this country believes in. That bloodthirst was there. We talk about enslavement, especially conservatives. They like to poo-poo enslavement. Let me do to your daughters, to your sons, what was done during enslavement, and I want to see you poo-poo it. Let me do to your daughters and sons what they did to those people to make more slaves, and I want you to tell me that there is nothing that was wrong with enslavement in this country. I always remember what de Tocqueville wrote about the enslavement practices in the United States. Which was, while yes, there had been enslavement throughout human history, this was the first time that it was squarely placed on race. And that there was no mechanism other than fleeing for ridding yourself of its burdens. The perpetualness of it was inhumane and unmatched in history. But let's not lose the point. There was a bloodthirst in it. And that's often left out. The stories that survived from enslavement, the dehumanization, which we often don't attribute to bloodthirst, but dehumanization has a scale. Dehumanization starts with name-calling. It ends with bodily harm, not murder, maiming. With bodily harm, it ends with the capacity to injure and maim. Now, yes, the ultimate dehumanization is killing for the sense of power over a victim. Yes. And even one would go far enough and say, if you desecrate the dead body, that is an act of dehumanization, and I understand it. But the reason why I stop short of killing is because the ultimate thrill of the barbarian who seeks to dehumanize, and here, yes, Europeans were barbaric. The ultimate thrill is bloodletting. The capacity to deconstruct a human being, make him an object, make her an object, deconstruct her until she is so injured or he is so injured on the floor that they need help to recompose themselves, to heal themselves. And they are allowed to do that, to build themselves up so that they never forget that they are less than. And the moment that that individual thinks that they are better than being less than, the moment that they have that spark of light in their eyes, then they have to be cut down again. And that's the dehumanization process. It is a cycle that does not continue through death. Though, if you look at it not from a personal perspective, but you look at it from a group perspective, then it transcends death because new blood, new individuals will come through and be refreshing that pot of individuals that will be dehumanized. That herd of individuals who will be dehumanized. This disgust that was during enslavement, during Jim Crow, that was tossed at people who did not believe what white people believed, comes down to this very day into these discussions of SEAL Team 6, of Second Amendment solutions. I have a proposition when it comes to the Second Amendment. Since they're so keen on the Second Amendment being followed, that's fine, let's do that. What kind of guns did they have available back then when the Second Amendment was ratified? That's cool. That's awesome. That's wonderful. Let's let them have those guns. But I digress. But if you really want to see what was hinted at by Trump's lawyers, you got to go... Well, we can start with the abolitionist movement. We can go back to Shay's Rebellion, which even has white supremacist overtones. But, or we can go to Jim Crow. We can go to Reconstruction, where the threat of political assassination followed black people everywhere. But let's not go there. Let's go to the labor movement of the late 1800s, early 1900s. Let's look at politicians who were promoting progressive policies that would put restraints on corporations and how they moved in this country. And do you know what you would find? You'd find dozens, if not hundreds, you would definitely find hundreds of political leaders, of labor leaders. Well, if we include labor leaders and we include labor members, now we're talking thousands who were murdered and disappeared. Who were murdered and disappeared. This history is deeply ingrained in the United States. That is what makes this whole thing frightening to me. They are tugging on terrifying ghosts that has haunted this country. From the standpoint of black people, from the standpoint of black folks who have been in this country and with this country since its inception, the threat of political violence is not new. But we are now at a period of time where isolated political assassinations could spiral quickly into social degeneration and social conflict. Why? Because those wedge issues that Gingrich started planting in this society way back in the 1980s, something that he's still doing to this day. Those wedge issues have severed social connections so that we can't even talk about unifying across ideologies any longer. Thank you, Gingrich. You're one of the worst human beings that was born onto this continent. You're a terrible man. And I know, who am I, right? But you are a terrible man. This is your doing. And history will not record it, but it needs to, because you started this. And before you come out and say, but I didn't want any violence of any, y'all have been working on dehumanizing Democratic Party members and dehumanizing Democratic supporters for years. That is how we went from calling them Democratic to Democrat. Because they didn't want the Democratic Party aligned with democracy. They wanted to reconstitute what democracy was. And in their efforts to reconstitute what democracy was, which, by the way, they were actually replacing the New Deal democratization of the economy with a Republicanist one. But in their efforts to do that, they began releasing the ghosts of the past in this country as they tried to rewind the clock. The funny thing about folks who try to rewind a social clock, they only focus on the aspects of the time period that they want to rewind back to that they feel best about. They never focus on what was actually happening. The period of time that these people want to rewind back to is the early 1900s, maybe the late 1800s, but they want corporations to have full control over the country, over the federal government, over a lot of the state governments. They want the old corporate machine politics of that era. Well, that was also the era of organized crime. That was also the era of political assassinations, of hefty beatings, of social conflict that rendered people bloodied and bruised. You had a lot of social fragmentation that went on during that period of time, which caused a lot of harm. In fact, there was a report from the late 30s, I think, maybe it was the early 40s, where it stated, yeah, it had to be the early 40s. It stated, when the United States exited World War II, there would be a recession, if not a significant depression, again. And the report postulated that if that was to happen, there was likely going to be social unrest, significant social unrest. What was to be done about that? Well, there needed to be a massive economic stimulus that was put into place. Now, they had two routes they could have went. They could have did what they were doing in Europe, which was build up the social welfare system in this country and build up the private sector, but aligned with social welfare mandates, or they could have went the military route. We all know which way they went. We all know which way they went. That is important. Why? Because the assassinations that would have likely took place in the 1950s, if the country had just been allowed to exist, quote, normally, the U.S. exits World War II, and instead of putting in place a Keynesian plan, rather it was military or it was something else. Actually, it was more New Deal and military than just military. But if they just allowed things to progress naturally, the assassinations that would have taken place most likely would have followed what McCartney did. The Red Scare of the 1950s would have likely been a bloodbath. Think about that. It would have likely been a bloodbath. It wouldn't have been just hearings and people getting kicked out of their homes and kicked out of their communities and kicked out of wherever, you know, their professions mainly. It would have literally been a bloodletting event. We avoided that because we made different social decisions. The destruction that is happening presently in this country, which has not been altogether abated by the policies of the government, is setting the stage for political violence at the hands of a group of people who do not want the government to solve the problems that is creating the stage for political violence. They want political violence. Why? That's the only way they stay in power. That is the only way they stay in power. I've talked to you many times about the demographic change. But I want you to really think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Keith Olbermann has spoken about the idea that many corporations have had these meetings, and probably all the big ones have had these meetings, where they've talked about if the United States reelects Trump and goes fascist, what are they going to do to continue being able to make their profits? You know another discussion all of them have had? Especially the ones who know they're going to be around in 30, 40 years. They've all had the discussion about what to do in a country like the United States when the demographics tip in less than 20 years. The numbers suggest that by 2042, this country is going to be what's called a majority-minority country, meaning white people will be the minority. Now, it's funny because white people are the minority on the planet anyway. Always have been, always will be. I suspect that if they're saying 2042, it's more likely going to be 2036 or 2038 or 2035 or something like that. That's when it's actually going to happen. But we probably won't know for certain until 2040. Once that occurs, once this country becomes a majority non-white country, the numbers exist to make this a social welfare heaven. The numbers exist. 85 to 90% of black people are going to vote with socially conscious Democrats. Or four, should I say, with socially conscious Democrats. The numbers suggest that 60% of what are called Latinos are going to vote for socially conscious or even moderately conscious Democrats. The same thing, a little bit higher, holds true for Asians. Over 95% of Native Indigenous people will. And just around 35% of whites will. Those numbers, and as the population ages, and yet the number of youth increase, white numbers will likely go up a bit. But those numbers mean the majority of this country by mid-decade, next decade, will vote for Democrats. And not only will they vote for Democrats, but this country is going to be increasingly more progressive. Once that happens, the Republicans are, thank you to Stuart Stevens, a permanent minority party. They will never again hold a solid majority unless they change who they are. Well, how do you prevent that from happening? Violence. Violence. A lot of people are applauding the South Africans over their charge of genocide, Palestinian genocide, at the International Court of Justice. Wonderful. But there's a lesson people are not learning from them. When it became clear that the minority white population was going to have to relinquish control of the country, and truthfully, they should have relinquished the resources to natural elements, that is, but they should have relinquished those to the South Africans too. But when it became clear that they had to relinquish governing power, in order to stave that off, what did they do? They committed massive violence. they committed massive violence because the minorities could not be allowed to rule. Now, mind you, even in South Africa, where the majority of people are African, they were still considered minorities, which should tell you that it doesn't have this majority-minority thing doesn't have to do with color. There's another reason why they call black people, brown people, red people, yellow people, minorities. The question is why? I digress, though. This is what we're facing. In 2015, late 2015, I was routinely purchasing the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I was purchasing a couple of other papers too, but definitely those two. And both of them ran amazing articles on the demographic changes of the world. The New York Times one was significantly longer than the one in the Wall Street Journal, but it was, both of them were good. Both of them were good. And I remember thinking, because this was asked in the article, how were white people in white institutions throughout the world going to adjust to the reality of not being able to say that they rule anymore because they're the majority? Now, that wasn't asked like that, but the New York Times asked the question, you know, how are institutions going to adjust to this new reality, basically? The answer was, well, obviously you got to hire more black people, brown people, people of all colors, and yada, yada, yada. But the reality is, I don't think that's the correct answer. I think in a lot of places, white people are going to use tricks to stay in power. In the United States, they've already been using tricks to stay in power, particularly conservatives. And now that those tricks are being exposed here in the United States, the only thing they have left is violence. Is violence. Once that is uncorked, it's never going to be put back into the bottle. I need y'all to understand this. It was political violence against the Gracchi, or Gracchi, who were seeking to make some reforms, which kicked off the initial cycles of violence, which really started to propel the Roman Republic towards dictatorship. One act of violence led to another. Those two acts led to a third. Those three acts led to a fourth. And soon, there wasn't any question in Rome whether or not there would be political violence. The question became, how long before there is more political violence? This is the true threat we face. And it's a threat that we can manage. Heck, it's a threat we can sidestep. But we have to make the choice to do so. I want to say one more thing before ending the show. The United States is experiencing a death right now. The death is linked to who we thought we were. Now, I say we because I'm an inclusive person. As black person and black people in general, we typically think differently of the United States and who the people within it think they are and who we know they have been. Well, for those who haven't done that work to see who the United States is, I really do invite you to start doing it. Why? Because one day you're going to wake up and you're going to realize that you don't know who you are or who your country is. And if you are not prepared to confront that reality with a new reality, thus transposing the old idea of who the United States is with one, with a newer one of who they are, you're going to be lost and you're going to become susceptible to the people who are calling for mob justice and violence. Now, notice, when I say mob justice, I'm not talking about true justice. I'm talking about the justice we saw on January 6th. That's what I'm talking about. I want to thank you all for listening. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. Radio4AIL.net. You can also catch me on WordPress. Class War Battlefield Podcast on WordPress. So WordPress/Class War Battlefield Podcast. You can catch me on Spotify, Amazon, and any other place you get your podcast just about. There's a few other places that I got to get to. Listener notes, if you know what that is. You can find me there. I really do appreciate y'all. And I'm not going to stick around long today. CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, PayPal, Cash App, if you love the work that I'm doing. I am your brother, Vimeir Diesel Gaia, and big up to Dr. Obatashaka, Baba, Dr. Obatashaka. Big up to the Professional Life Podcast, the best podcast you should be listening to. Black Power Media, Roland Martin, and Best Still Left Podcast, Armageddon Update, Democracy Now!, Sam Cedars, Majority Report, just all y'all are wonderful, keep doing you. There's a whole list of leftist media sources on my WordPress blog. Alright y'all, until the next one. I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance. Listening to Class War Battlefield Podcast, episode 2024.00.00. The references contained in today's episode include at the 1 minute 13 second mark, originally published on January 11th, 2024. Hayes, we are already living with a version of Trump's SEAL Team 6 argument. This is from All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. At the 9-minute, 45-second mark, originally published on January 10th, 2024, let's talk about Trump, SEAL Team 6, and rivals. This is from Bo of the Fifth Column, which you can find on YouTube. At the 14-minute, 15-second mark, originally published on January 10th, 2024, new Trump terror threat. Countdown with Keith Olbermann. This is obviously from Countdown with Keith Olbermann. At the 22-minute, 56-second mark, originally published on May 18th, 2015, Eisenhower's farewell address, his military-industrial complex warning. This is from the YouTube channel Iwafa. I do not know what Iwafa means, spelled E-W-A-F-A. And finally, at the 39-minute and 2-second mark, originally published on May 23rd, 2013, from the President's Archive, Barack Obama defends drone strikes, but says, no cure all. This was published on PBS News Hours YouTube channel. You can find the complete list with links included of these references on my WordPress blog, the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Thank you again, and I'll see you on the next one.